Love it. Chris, you worked at the wildly successful 60 Minutes news program.
Still is.
Why hasn't it been copied?
Well, it has been copied, sometimes successfully and sometimes not. Why was it always so popular? One, Don Hewitt was the guy who created 60 Minutes, along with Mike Wallace. Hewitt always would say, tell me a story. Of course, there's tension. There would be Mike Wallace calling up or stopping somebody. Whatever they were doing, it always, though, had to center around it being a story.
So you're saying it had to be a story?
So that tactic that you just did, where the narrator, Mike Wallace or Scott Pelley, will repeat the key point, ask it in form of the question, have the guest then say, yes, exactly. That's a way to advance the story. So one was always tell a story. Second thing was one day I came into the office early, 8 a.m., and it wasn't anybody there. And I was in the hallway, and all of a sudden coming down the hallway, running down the hallway, it was Don Hewitt. And he's looking into offices, and he's looking at, you know, the offices of the really senior people, and he can't find him. No one's there. But he's going office to office to office. He's like running. He's got this energy about him. He comes up to me, and I was super junior. And he's like, you're not going to believe what just happened. And I said, what? He said, we just got so-and-so for an interview for this Sunday. And he was so excited. He had done the JFK-Nixon debates. He had launched the longest running, single most powerful show in television. He was at the height of his powers. And he's running down the halls, and there's some kid, he probably doesn't even know his name, and yet he was so excited, still hadn't become jaded, that all he wanted to do was share that excitement with somebody. It was a great lesson for me.
Well, that's how excited I was, but I found out that Chris Reback would be on my show.
It's kind of parallel.
In March 2020, I decided to do this program originally as a conference call, audio only.
What happens next? You mean a year and a half ago when you launched the media giant, what happens next?
Exactly. People said, why isn't it a Zoom? I mean, I prefer audio. So why do some people prefer audio to video?
I mean, to be clear, video is not going away, and video drives more viewership than audio does listener-wise. Hewitt used to listen to cuts of the 60 Minutes pieces with his eyes closed. It had to make sense in audio. The storytelling had to be there. Even in video, the audio portion is important. I think the power of audio and the power of podcasts, it's the form of content that you can take in, you can transfer your focus to the content while still taking care of other things, right? You can't do that when you read or, you know, you a TV, you can have the TV on in the background while you're doing something else, but you're not engaging with the TV content. It's just kind of keeping you company. But with audio, with the podcast, you can go really deep into content and have that be your focus while still taking care of other activities.
Every morning I look at my inbox and I've got an email from Chris Reback for his highly edited, curated news of the day.
Yes.
And that allows you to read all sorts of periodicals that I would never read. You're engaged in the world of news and content more than any other friend of mine. What are you seeing that's incredible?
There are really smart people out there who have the ability to go very deep into their areas of expertise and deliver insights, analysis, knowledge, and sometimes better original reporting than a more generalized publication like the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, FT, whatever. My very best example of this is Ben Thompson, who has a blog, a website called Stratechery. He connects strategy and technology. He's born and raised in Wisconsin, worked for a while at Apple, maybe at Microsoft, and decided for personal reasons to live in Taiwan. And he puts out a product that is a must read.
I did an episode with Mark Mahaney, who's a top internet analyst. He thinks that Spotify is a great stock to buy because of the growth prospects in podcasts. It isn't clear to me who should enjoy the profits of podcasts. Is it the creator or the platform?
I don't think it'll end up being different than any other media segment. There's always going to be a tension among the content creators and the people who can bring together audiences. If you're a really talented content creator who can create her own audience, then you don't need Spotify. The thing Spotify is doing that's really useful to advertisers, Spotify knows who is listening, and they will start to give you the data on your listeners.
Jim Miller in his podcast with me mentioned that HBO was unable to learn about its viewers because the customer had a direct relationship with the cable company and not with HBO. Why is this customer information so valuable?
Because businesses can sell against it. They can segment and they can then target. Netflix has that incredible data, but Netflix is a subscriber business. And so the way that Netflix monetizes that data is by delivering then to you, the user, more content so that you keep subscribing so that they can raise prices as they just did this week. Spotify has both. They have a subscription and an advertising model. So Spotify takes its data to the advertisers to better target the advertising.
Most of our listeners probably don't remember that Chris Reback broke into sports journalism when he was a sports writer for the California Berkeley newspaper.
Yes.
Chris, you love sports. You love sports news, as do I.
Yes.
I was an early subscriber to the internet magazine newspaper, The Athletic, that was recently acquired by the New York Times. I'm a Chicago sports fan, but I do not subscribe to a Chicago newspaper because the journalistic quality was so bad. It's just too painful to read.
Right.
The Athletic offers news on every sports team, but I only read about the Chicago teams. The Athletic journalists are just not first rate. They're fourth rate. And yet, what do? I read every word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sports betting is a big business, and the challenge is buying subscribers to make those bets. Do you think that the future of sports journalism is to facilitate sports betting?
I would have thought that FanDuel would have been a potential buyer of The Athletic. Every brand is a media company, and the whole purpose of content is to attract audiences. The Athletic would be competing with the Chicago Tribune sports section, would be competing against the single blogger. You don't have to turn to the traditional Sports Illustrated or Chicago Tribune.
I remember you subscribed to Sports Illustrated. You were my last friend to actually subscribe to that magazine, and you loved it.
Loved it. I would race home every Thursday afternoon, and on the way home, go through in my head, what do I think should be the cover story? I know that when you got the swimsuit issue, you read that cover to cover.
No, it was the Wall Street Journal.
I would read Sports Illustrated cover to cover the minute I got it.
There are journalists like George Will who have an audience. Mm-hmm. Substack allows individual authors to publish to a larger audience. How do you think about journalists building their own brand and distributing their product to a broad audience without a publisher?
There are two ingredients to that equation. One is desire and the other is leverage. Who has the leverage? Does the individual name have the leverage? Does the New York Times need Thomas Friedman or does Thomas Friedman need the New York Times?
Let's use Barry Weiss as an example. She used to write for the New York Times. She quit and then she immediately introduced the Barry Weiss podcast, Honestly. She also uses Substack for her written work.
I think you just picked a terrific example. She has an audience. She has people who are wanting to read or hear about her reporting. She was in a situation where not only did she have greater leverage than the platform for her own personal desires and personal goals, but it was getting between her and her audience. And that's the key. So if you want to ask what the future of media, it is continually tightening, getting closer with the relationship between the content creator and the audience. And getting that delta as small as possible. Have you watched Monday Night Football? Have you been watching the Manning cast at all? Peyton and Eli Manning?
I know it. I read about it in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, before the Wall Street Journal sports section found out about it, Harrison, Karen, and Chris Reback knew about it. And it's fantastic. You're watching the game with your boys, Peyton and Eli. It's such a smart creation. There are other examples I am now seeing of this where third-party providers are bringing together celebrities in a shared environment. You're connecting with celebrities online, kind of the way you and I are right now, you know, in this Zoom-like product.
I like to watch my sports pre-recorded, and I'm offered a choice of watching the Bulls games with the visitors' team's audio or with Stacey King and your Chicago Bulls. And I always choose Stacey King because I want a biased Chicago audio.
You want someone who's going to get as angry when things don't go
right. This isn't right. Well, how could he make that call?
Yeah.
What's he not running back down the court for? What's wrong with that guy?
Come on now.
So in lieu of listening to Stacey King, I could choose Chris Reback's audio for the game. And that would be even so much better than King, because now my best friend is going to tell me what's going to happen. And I think the platform should love the fact that they can get free content out of Chris Reback. I want to go back to Barry Weiss, because she's doing something that's very different than the type of moderation that I do. And I want to understand the future of moderation in journalism. I try desperately not to express an opinion, not to be too emotive, and inject myself into the storyline. On the other hand, Barry Weiss does exactly the opposite. She injects her personal feelings, her personal history, and her emotive power directly into the story. And she becomes a character on the show. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about putting the journalist into the storyline?
It's opinion. That's content. That can be enlightening and smart. I am most comfortable in the content that I create being as neutral or as fair in terms of context as possible. Now, you asked about the newsletters. That's judgment. I will get judged by my subscribers on whether my judgment on what I put in, how I frame it, what I connect, the pieces that I connect, whether in their estimation, I'm doing that in a way that makes them smarter. And if I were to do it in a way that seemed, you know, off or biased or, you know, somehow cheating the system, they wouldn't come to me for that. I'm not their guy.
There are a lot of news aggregators out there, and Morning Brew is probably the most famous example. How do you think about your competition in the curated morning newspaper business?
It's a big internet. I mean, you remember the old IKEA ads? It's a big world. Someone's got to
furnish it. Yeah.
I tried to describe my value proposition to you. I don't sell news. I sell judgment. I will have to demonstrate that I can deliver a better product. And I define better by helping subscribers save time and stay smarter.
When we were roommates after college in New York City, you worked for Day One, the ABC News magazine, and I was employed by Salmon Brothers. And the thought that you would end up at Salmon Smith Barney and working there for a longer period of time than I did would have been absurd. And yet that's exactly what happened.
Absurd.
You headed content for the City Corporate and Investment Bank, and your objective was to allow City's customers to access the firm's creative content. And I think the point you made in your original six-minute presentation is that every business wants to generate their own content and tell their story. What distinguishes City from most other companies is that they actually are in the business of writing research reports and having opinions, but most other companies aren't. I had the president of Stanley Black & Decker North America, Catherine Minasabian, on What Happens Next, and I asked her, why do I have to watch a YouTube of someone else using your product? Why aren't you creating your own content to show me how to use your product better?
What does every brand want? They want to be top of mind even when they're not physically present. There would be nothing better than to have a Black & Decker representative in the Home Depot where the Black & Decker stuff is being sold, having one-on-one conversations with every customer and potential customer. That's the best. Just doesn't scale so well. The whole goal of content is how do you use your intelligence, deliver that content in a targeted way so that you can stay relevant and top of mind and become their first call. If you're a lawyer, you want to be the first call. If you're an investment banker, when that CEO has a question or a problem, you want to be the first call.
I let my guests open with a six-minute presentation. I don't know any other news source that allows the speaker to define the subject content and then give them 6 minutes to sell it. I mean, 6 minutes is forever in radio. If no one else does it, does that mean that I'm wrong?
If activities executed by Larry Bernstein that no one else does equaled something wrong, well, Larry, you'd be in there. There's so much. I mean, where do we, the things that you do that nobody else does? So no, that alone is not evidence of your wrongness. And no, in fact, and you and I've had this conversation, I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's because you had the benefit, have the benefit of coming at this from an outside perspective, from a unique perspective, right? You're looking at it and you're like, wait a minute, this makes no sense. I'm tuning into something to hear this source. Why don't I want to hear from the source?
The difference between live and editorial programming, I mean, live is cheap. You could just roll that camera. Eyeballs want high quality. Should we expect podcasts to move towards a highly edited form or a free-flowing conversation? Do people just love live?
We have to differentiate between live and unedited. The beauty of live is that the event is happening right then, the football game, the presidential debate. You don't know what'll happen next, so the viewer needs to tune in right then. That's valuable. From a production point of view, a listener or viewer will have much more forgiveness about the quality of a product if it is literally live. Even in podcasts, which historically have been people talk and you just kind of record whatever happens, that was version 1.0 of podcasting. Listen, there will always be live, but if something doesn't have to be live, editing makes the production better. And content consumers know the difference. But now let's talk economics. The economic difference between the cost of doing live versus the cost of doing edited or curated content, there's a massive difference. It costs much more to edit or curate content. That's why cable channels put live panels on the air all day long. It's so cheap to make. It just comes down, like everything else, to the business and monetization model. If you can charge a premium for edited content, you'll do it. If you can't charge a premium for the edited content, then you're not going to make the edited content because it costs too much to make.
Chris, I end each show on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
I'm super optimistic about the fact that anyone can be a media company. You know, when you and I were growing up, if someone wanted to broadcast something, you had to own CNN or you had to own CBS or own the New York Times. I love the fact that people can deliver their own content. I'm even willing to live with some of the costs of that.
Chris, thank you. And thank you for being a lifelong friend.
Yeah, my pleasure. And my thanks to you on that front, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks to Ari and Chris for joining us today. That ends today's session. I want to make a plug for next week's show. I will be joined by two of my buddies. Jeremy Clorfine is a clinical psychologist at Rush Medical Center in Chicago, and he's going to speak about how COVID is impacting young adults' mental health. Our second speaker will be Avi Bernstein, who is one of the top orthopedic surgeons in Chicago. I want to find out from Avi if back fusions work or is it just bullshit? This is going to be a blast. If you're interested in listening to a replay of today's What Happens Next program or any of our previous episodes, or if you wish to read a transcript, you can find them on our website, whathappensnextin6minutes.com. Replays are also available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Goodbye.